This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The hallmark of Rick Snyder's tenure as the governor of Michigan has been his relentless drive to run government like a business. Many believe putting that bottom line first is what helped cause the Flint water crisis. And privatizing state services to cut cost has led to failures. Think of the recent scathing audit of the Grand Rapids Home for Veterans and the many problems with bringing in air to feed prison inmates, problems from rotting food to food service employees having sexual encounters with prisoners in food coolers. So Governor Snyder's proposed budget for the new fiscal year certainly caught the collective attention of Michigan's mental health community. The state's $2.4 billion mental health care system caught the eye of the governor. He's proposing turning a large part of that funding to Medicaid HMOs, the largest of which are for profit. Let us see what cutting mental health costs could mean as we welcome Kevin Fisher, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan. Good to have you with us, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it seems that the biggest change the governor proposed with his budget when he announced it in January is just who would control the purse strings. Give us a sense, who controls the purse strings now and how is that working for patients and families?
Currently, the purse strings are handled or services are delivered by what we know as the community mental health coalitions, which consist of either mental health authorities or in certain parts of the state they're referred to as PIHPs, prepaid insurance health plans. And so it is what we know as the public mental health system. Persons that live with mental illness can come to them for services, and those services are contracted out to other service providers.
So what problems are the governor trying to address with this proposal?
Savings. It simply comes down to trying to run this service like a business, and mental health care is, like many other examples that we've experienced, is one of those services that there's more to than just the bottom line.
So the idea that the governor's budget would have Medicaid money going through HMOs rather than straight to these community mental health services, as you described, what worries do you have about that?
There are many. The first is loss of public oversight. Whenever there's a for-profit that's managing the purse strings, for example, Molina, Meridian, the Blues, they are headquartered somewhere else, and they serve a board of directors and shareholders. And I like to say, by definition, the business of a for-profit is to make a profit and return shareholder value. The difference here, specific to community mental health, is where insurance companies tend to minimize risk so they can enhance shareholder value, public mental health services are designed to run toward risk. We seek out the persons who most need those services and bring them into the system. So at the end of the day, the entire community benefits when you have persons with mental illnesses receiving services and they're able to live thoughtful, productive lives, the entire community benefits, as opposed to if there's a private entity managing that. Services tend to be reduced to maximize profit. And then there are services that a traditional HMO wouldn't recognize that persons who currently receive mental health, community mental health services thrive on.
Such as
person-centered planning, for example. A large part of the services that are derived from community mental health is to allow a person the opportunity to live a fruitful life, to say, I want to go to school. I liked job training. I'd like to live independently in housing. Those types of things where traditional insurance companies tend to look at, well, you need a prescription, whether or not that's filled. Do you need a doctor visit? Is it necessary? Can you go without that doctor visit? And it's all to control cost. And they don't really take into account those specialty services that help those individuals lead productive lives.
And when we're talking about these individuals, we are really, it's no exaggeration to say they are among Michigan's most vulnerable. We're talking about people who are mentally ill, developmentally disabled, battling substance abuse, autism. So on the ground level, what What could that change? What could things look like for these families and for these people?
Well, imagine going back to the early 1990s under the Engler administration when we closed all of the state hospitals. We experienced an explosion in homelessness because those persons were intended to be sent home. However, what happens when you send a person with a mental illness home, for example, the parent may not know how to manage that. They don't know what services are available. They don't know where to get services. And unfortunately, many people end up either the caregiver is frustrated or the person receiving or in need of services is frustrated, and they leave and they end up out on the street.
Or in prison.
Or in prison, which is the highest cost place to put them.
Now, supporters of the governor's plan, when it was first announced in January, said, well, it's not really privatizing mental health because a lot of these Medicaid HMOs are nonprofit, and this is going to be a way of allowing a bigger pool of money to find its way to actual treatment.
Well, what ends up happening is that, and the lieutenant governor explained this to those of us in the newly formed work group, it doesn't specifically immediately privatize mental health services, but it opens the door for privatized mental health services. And that's where the concern came in for persons like myself and the advocacy community and many, many families and caregivers.
All right. Now, you mentioned this work group because this brings us up to date to the more recent development, which was after the outcry and pushback from parents and stakeholders in the mental health community. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly says, all right, we're going to sit down and we're going to come to some kind of compromise. Tell me about this work group and how you see this working.
So the work group is very interesting. The initial group that the lieutenant governor called together consisted of approximately 30 or so agencies. Either there were representatives from community mental health organizations, advocacy groups like myself, and others. That group has expanded. Probably within a week, it had doubled in size to approximately 60 persons because we said, well, we want to have individuals and family members and caregivers who experience day to day what the system looks like to have their input.
So you're not all sitting around talking about
exactly
things that matter desperately to people on a day to day basis.
Exactly. And, you know, I give the lieutenant governor credit because his focus was, we don't want to talk from the top down to the persons who receive the services and tell them what they should be. We should be asking them, what makes you successful, and build the system from the way up. So I give the lieutenant governor quite a bit of credit for that.
So what's going to happen?
So that's a tough question.
Because the budget generally gets approved by the legislature in early June, doesn't it?
Well, there lies the rub, as they say. When the lieutenant governor formed the work group, he said, we are going to set aside the boilerplate under Section 298.
And explain that what that is.
That's what we're talking about now, this potential privatization of the community mental health business. And said, the budget process is going to continue to move forward with an anticipated completion date, late May, early June. The concern many of us in the work group had was, is there truly enough time to consider thoughtful, fact-driven, data-driven alternatives to what the governor has proposed? And for lack of a better term, are we working with a gun to our head to the point that if we are not able to produce an alternative that the governor approves, then are you telling us the original boilerplate language stays? Again, in fairness to the lieutenant governor, there was not a specific answer yes, but we have to make the assumption that the answer is yes, especially since we were given this timeline. Now, there is quite a bit of debate amongst the advocacy community and even the legislators themselves as to, are we tied to this timeline of having something in place by June? And I think the honest answer has to be no. And I've spoken with members of the legislature, specifically members of the Appropriations Subcommittee, and they are in agreement that we don't believe that between now and, let's say, June 1st is adequate time for thoughtful, data-driven alternatives. And there's been a lot of suggestion that we should even explore a pilot test in both an urban and rural section of Michigan to best determine how it would work rather than flip the whole system at one time, not knowing what the alternatives would be, very similar to the change in the food supplier and the prison system, the change at the VA hospital in Grand Rapids, Flint Water. We don't want to and don't need to make such a drastic change and then find out what the repercussions are. That's not a good way to run business or the state.
Kevin, you said at the very beginning, really the problem the governor was addressing was to cut cost.
Yes.
How much would the state save by doing things the way the governor spelled out?
So there's no real agreement on that. My understanding is when the HMOs approached the administration, there was a suggestion that $200+ million could be saved by making this change. However, many organizations like the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Plans and others have started to delve into that and say, we don't see those savings. And again, there are members of the legislature who say, we're very skeptical of, is that the correct number? And how do you arrive at that number? Because are you cutting administrative costs or at some point are you going to cut care?
I would wonder, as you and I talk, the state is digesting the recently released Flint Water Advisory Task Force report that really was scathing toward the state's failure on every level, including the governor, to look out for the people of Flint. I would wonder if that add the stories of the Aramark problems and the Grand Rapids Veterans Home, the terrible audit. If there is not a sense in the governor's office of maybe we do need to rethink this, are you hearing any of that at all?
Honestly, no. And that's one of the things that really concerns me about the administration coming from the top down from the governor's office. The reason that we're at the point we are now with the work group really came out of not a rethinking from the administration. It was because of all of the uproar that came about from parents and advocacy organizations saying, no, stop, this is not good. Had we not raised our voices, he would have continued to move forward. You know, the other real concern there is there are many mechanisms for the administration to reach out to get the pulse of the people. For example, I also sit on what's called the Behavioral Health Advisory Council. And we meet quarterly, and at those meetings, there are members from the Department of Health and Human Services. Very often, Deputy Director Linda Zeller comes in and presents to us. And at each of those meetings, we ask, what issues can we help you with? And the answer for the last 2 years that I've sat on that committee has been, nothing, we're okay. So when this boilerplate language came out in the budget, we were all very surprised, frankly felt blindsided and upset because we asked, where can we help you? And you told us the help wasn't needed.
Well, that kind of echoes what the response was when people in Flint tried to raise concerns about bottles of urine-colored water.
There appears to be a pattern of behavior, and with all due respect to the governor and his administration, I would think by now that because of after living through Aramark, the VA hospital, Flint, you would take a look at how you're operating and say, maybe we need to slow down. Maybe we need to get others in the boat with us before we decide to make such drastic changes. And frankly, with all of those things going on, we were all really surprised in the mental health community that this was an issue that he even wanted to tackle, because I'm relatively new to the mental health advocacy field. I've been executive director for only 2 years now. But one of the things that the concerns that I have is we're treating Michigan's community mental health system as if it's broken. And it's not. It's not broken. Are there areas to be improved? Absolutely. Is there always a need to look at reducing and controlling administrative costs? Absolutely. But there's no fire in Michigan's public mental health system right now that should bring us to the level of we need to burn it down and start all over.
And I know that your executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan, you say this has been for a couple of years. So there is that level, but this is deeply personal for you because of your own story.
Oh, absolutely. Like many mental health advocates, I got involved with NAMI in late 2010 after losing my oldest son, Dominique, to suicide. After he had been diagnosed with bipolar and schizophrenia in 2007. And I learned firsthand the frustration that parents and individuals who actually live with mental illness go through when they're trying to find out what services are available, how do I access them. And in saying that, it's not because there's a flaw with Michigan's system. It really has to do with our comfort and understanding of simply what services are available. For example, if you slip and fell and fractured your ankle, you would know to go to the emergency room. You have a certain understanding of they're going to set it and those kinds of things. But mental health is a conversation we're so uncomfortable having that most of us don't know what services are available already. And so it's not a complaint and it's not a negative when I say that persons who are seeking services in Michigan don't know where to look. It's not that the services aren't there. They just don't know how to access
them. Well, who wants to think that you would need that?
Exactly.
You don't want to be part of that club.
Exactly.
And then suddenly you are.
Exactly. And, you know, mental health is one of those illnesses that there's an incredible stigma. There's shame. There's a sense that it's self-brought on or it's a personal weakness or you must have had a substance abuse issue before your mental health issue. And more often than not, it's actually the reverse. Many people who have substance abuse issues have underlying mental health issues, and they started their substance abuse problem by self-medicating.
So looking ahead, it seems that we need to keep our eye on this work group meeting with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly.
Absolutely, because, again, the Lieutenant Governor has taken a great first step. I think this aggressive timeline is not reasonable, and I think we need to slow down and say, let's get a thoughtful, fact-driven process and develop alternatives that way rather than making a significant change to the system and then finding out we've gone in the wrong direction.
Kevin Fisher is Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us, Kevin.
Thank you so much for having me.